Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Jesse Johnson, appellant, versus the State of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Alicia Filler, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Caroline Cirska, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Filler, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. For these individuals, interpreters are not a handy convenience. They are a necessity. Those words are from the 2013 State of the Judiciary message, where Chief Justice was speaking of a person with little or no skills in English and how they would do to understand the procedures and consequences of our legal system in South Dakota. For Jesse Johnson, this necessity of meaningful access to the court system triggered on February 6, 2012, when he was interrogated by the investigator. If we can't expect a citizen to understand the procedures in our legal system, how can we expect him to understand the implications, meanings, and consequences of not C-U-S-T-O-D-I-A-L? Interview. That's what was interpreted to him. It was spelled. And that by, he also needs to understand that by talking, he was renouncing his rights, his right to leave. As I'm sure there won't be enough time for me to address all the issues in my brief, I would just like to also incorporate my brief by reference here, so as not to waive any issues.
Right at the outset, we certainly understand the significance of what you just said. But, you know, in a lot of cases, there's no discussion with the defendant about whether it's a custodial or non-custodial interview before the process starts. In fact, I would venture to say, I mean, this might be an exception. We decide lots of cases and whether the interview was custodial without an advisement, you know, to the defendant that it's custodial versus non-custodial. What's your response to that?
Well, I guess I would respectfully disagree that it's not standard. In many of the police reports I review, Rapid City, when they bring someone to the police station, they say the very same thing, that this interview is non-custodial, doors unlocked. They say those things and then let the person leave in order to create the guise that the person is not in custody and what they say isn't going to impact them. And the fact that Investigator Schultz did read the statement and then hand the statement to him just creates the suggestion and the hope that it's going to be convincing that it wasn't custodial when, in fact, because of the interpretation errors, his understanding, and the nature of the interview, it was, in fact, custodial.
Well, I guess my point is it's not like Miranda where there has to be an affirmative act, where there has to be an affirmative advisement. It's not quite the same.
I agree it's not exactly the same because Miranda is something entirely different than the right to free to leave, but it is a right. His right to leave should be treated as the right to remain silent. And the fact that that wasn't communicated to him that he could leave is where the issue is.
That's one of the factors we look at.
Yes.
In the totality of the circumstances to determine if it's custodial.
Absolutely.
Okay. But is there any question? I didn't see any argument that he couldn't read.
His learning reading comprehension was not fabulous. And there is some discussion of that in Anner Witter Merrithew, and I believe in Dr. Manlove's report, he references Dr. Scoville's report assessing his vocabulary. He grew up, I think when he was about 18 months old, Jesse Johnson went deaf. He was then, by the age of 3, shipped hundreds of miles from his home to the North Dakota School for the Deaf, where they taught him ASL. ASL is not English. It is a very distinct language from English and signed English, which is also a different language. And so his first language is American Sign Language, which is not a written language. It is a signed language. So his reading comprehension, while it may not be in the record, was not good. It's it's a difficult situation because trying to communicate with him in writing for me was extremely difficult. So I know it's not part of the record, and I guess that was a failure on my part to highlight the fact that he can't read very well. And that ties into, though, the other issue, because the suggestion, and I think the circuit court heavily relied upon that written statement. The written statement that he was first read to him and then signed inaccurately and at best extremely confusing as to what it meant. And then he's handed this document to read. And if you watch the video, he looks for guidance and he is told by Schultz through Katie Peter or through the interpreter, do you understand? Write yes or no. And he writes no. Now it appears when you take the paper separate than watching it with the video that he wrote, do you have questions? No, but that's not an accurate representation. He was told, do you understand? Write yes or no. And he wrote no, relying heavily upon the interpretation. And I think the issue is the reasonable man in the defendant's position. And that's where we want to look to is what's a reasonable person in Jesse Johnson's position going to understand at the time of this interrogation? And you have to consider the fact that he is deaf. And it's not a disability. He's a capital D deaf. He means his culture is deaf. That's his believement is deaf. He's not hard of hearing. He is deaf. And there's this misguided, and it's more a societal misguidedness of what is deaf and what it means to be deaf. And it's a complete separate culture that has different norms, different understandings, and clearly a different language. And he also, at the time of this interrogation, was the only suspect in a first-degree rape. He was told to come to the public safety building, which is sheriff's and state's attorney's office in Rapid City, and he was placed with an interpreter aligned with the investigator. There's nothing to dispute the fact that that interpreter was pulled aside and said, will you help me interrogate him because we think he committed a rape. And
but didn't he have a relationship? He had a your client had a relationship with this interpreter too, didn't he?
I don't want to say relationship.
Well,
because
that's probably the wrong word, but I mean, he had worked with her for years.
Over the course of about 3 years, I think there was, I think her testimony was about up to 10 times that she had worked with him. Most of those were vocational settings, maybe a job interview or communicating that way, or a counseling session. Nothing with the implications of a legal setting. And when you suggest 3 years, that may suggest that he worked with her consistently. But it was every couple months because deaf people in Rapid City, when they need an interpreter, usually the hearing person calls the agency that then brings someone down. He didn't get a pick and choose who he wanted as an interpreter ever, let alone when this interrogation took place. Then not only was she aligned with the state in this case, or with the investigator in the state, she provided an inferior transliteration. And I think that's an important fact because as I was talking about the deaf culture and ASL, American Sign Language, being a different language, what she did as a transliterator, what she acknowledged, is transliteration is translating a spoken word into signed English. It's a word-for-word signing. And American Sign Language has different ways and different organizations of how you put your words together and where the verb goes and where the noun goes. And what she did was just signed English. And that is what she is qualified to do. And as his first language is ASL, it wasn't meaningful to him. It wasn't communicated accurately to him. It's no trying to think of two languages that are somewhat similar. I guess somewhat Spanish and French have some consistencies that some people can meet the same words, but it doesn't mean if someone speaks French to you that that's as good as a Spanish interpretation. Okay, it's a distinct language. And we can't ignore the errors in her interpretation, and those are highlighted in the expert report of Anna Witter Merrithew. The free to leave is the biggest issue. And his statement, what he signed, if we're done, then what? What she vocalized for him, when we are done, and actually it's, I guess, I don't know what the point, like when we are done, then what happens? Two dramatically different things that trigger different burdens and a different meeting. And it's that's part of the reason I cited the Nebraska versus Rogers case, because in there she says, I'm done, clearly in English, so we understand I'm done. Response, just listen then. And that wasn't good. That wasn't acceptable. Her statement was suppressed because she was tried to exert that she wants to be done, and they didn't let her. Now we're in custodial. And his response, Investigator Schultz's response to Peterson's words, when we're finished, then I'll explain the whole process of what's going on. He expressed a desire to end, and he was brushed off. That's custody. Okay, if we're done, I want to leave. Oh, we'll get to that later. And he can't, no reasonable person, even if this was all words and not signs, no reasonable person would think they were free to leave when they expressed a desire to leave and they were told, we'll worry about it later. And part of in the state's brief response, they were talking a bit about how he was free to move about the public safety building. And he wasn't free to move about the public safety building. He was in that room, and he needed to be in that room until he was told he could go sit in the lobby. And the state suggests that at that point he could have left. And I would submit that a deaf person in Rapid City, if you take their cell phone from them, it's equivalent to taking crutches from someone that needs the assistance to walk. Because that was his communication to his mother, who was hearing, to his employer. Okay, he spoke via text language, much like teenagers' text language, with people in order to communicate. And so to suggest that because he was in the lobby, he was free to leave when he was told to wait is misplaced at best. The custody factors that I think I highlight in the brief, which a lot of what I've talked about that are from Tuttle and Rogers, who cites Axon, all point to the fact that Jesse Johnson's in custody. I think if you went through each one of the points, it suggests custodial. And the suggestion that just because he was free to leave means he wasn't in, or just because he got to go back to his hotel after the interview, doesn't equate to non-custodial. Because what happened at the end of the interview, the only thing that needed to be done was the investigator needed to submit it to the state's attorney's office to get the warrant for arrest. No additional information was learned. Investigator Schultz knew where he was living, knew where he worked, knew his cell phone, and knew how to contact
him. But when he left that jail, he could have gotten in the car and driven to Seattle.
Potentially.
I mean, there was no kind of hold on him or anything, was there?
No, there was no hold on him, except his life was there. It's a bond factor, in essence, when you talk about bond factors in circuit court. Does he have ties somewhere else? No. His life was in Rapid City, South Dakota. And so to suggest that, sure, he could have left, absolutely, we all could leave at any point. It doesn't mean it's reasonable for him to not think that he was free to leave. He had continuing contact with Investigator Schultz.
But the test is, would an objective person believe they were not free to leave? We don't use a subjective test, do we? We're not asking what he thought. We're asking, would an objectively reasonable person believe they had the right to leave?
I think the test is an objective view of the reasonable man test. So it's not an objective reasonable man. I think it's just a reasonable man.
Maybe I overstated it, but you stated it correctly. But so how does that test apply here? I mean, and how does it help your client? Because obviously your client, we can't look at his situation subjectively.
Well, I think objectively, you go through the factors that are set forth in the case law. Objectively, was he free to move throughout the building where he was? No. Okay, so a reasonable person, if they were told to sit there and stayed there by law enforcement, the command of authority, wouldn't think he was free to leave. And I think you also have to add, and I would submit that it's a reasonable deaf person standard for Mr. Johnson, and the deaf, capital D, deaf culture is a there's this an acquiescence to authority because they're so reliant upon other people. So he didn't move until he was told to move. And then you look at the length and you go through objectively the hours. It was 2.5 hours, a little over. You look at objectively Anna Witter and Merrithew's report that there were errors. You look objectively at the clear confusion over the written note and how that manifests itself in the video. You'll look at the objective factor that he was the sole custody, or the sole suspect, excuse me, in a first-degree rape case. You look at the objective test that he was told, we know you did this. We know, repeatedly, I know this kid can make this up. I know this happened. You need to tell me how it happened. I know it happened. And that was repeatedly told to him. So a reasonable person, that's not subjective. You get to look at above that. And constantly, Investigator Schultz repeatedly said, I know you did this. Explain it to me so it's not so bad. Okay? And that's objective. Objectively, the investigation was complete. And they told him it was complete, in essence. We've interviewed her. We know it's happened. Okay? The other objective factors are, again, set forth in the brief, the location. It's at the police station. It's not at his house. It's not somewhere where he could feel that he was free to move about. It was initiated by law enforcement. That's an objective factor. There were no neutral parties present. And I said the duration. And then the objective factor of how the interrogation was verbally dominated by the investigator. He was not aggressive. This investigator was certainly not aggressive, and I would concede that. He sat down and he talked to him and he utilized the interpreter. He was confrontational. They repeatedly said, well, we know and you need to tell us. That's not true. Kids can't make it up. He was accusatory. You did this. I know you did this. He wasn't threatening, but he also used other techniques. The techniques of giving the alternatives. Well, either you're a horrible pedophile that scoops kids up, or you were just trying to teach her. And that's a technique, and that's a manipulation, and that's, again, an objective factor that you can review when you watch the DVD. And the last factor that cites Axum is that the police told the defendant a belief that the defendant was culpable and they had the evidence to prove it. There was no question that Investigator Schultz repeatedly told Jesse Johnson that he had the evidence to prove it, because kids don't lie. I've been doing this a long time. Kids don't make this up. And I think those are the objective factors that you get to look at. Time goes too fast.
Can I ask you one question about, yes. It's actually your last issue, and I didn't know if you were going to raise it or not, but it's a concern that the state withheld the physical examination of this child until after the trial. And I'm wondering about the prejudice. Was your client's defense at the trial that he didn't do it and that the police simply forced him to admit that he did it? Was that his defense?
Yes, basically. That there were interpretation errors, that he never actually said touched or penetrate. It was show, and penetration was the element that we argued that it never happened.
So the physical exam certainly would have assisted you in some way. I guess it was a year later, though, so I don't know.
No, the physical exam was February of 2012.
Okay.
We didn't learn about it till sentencing, when I questioned the restitution figure that they were asking for. And I actually suggested in sentencing, is this a counseling record that I didn't get because I had a motion for counseling
records. How close was the examination to the actual, the last physical touching, the physical molestation? That's my point. I mean, would it have revealed something if there had been?
I don't know if it would have revealed something. I still haven't received it. It could have. It could have not. I would submit that it showed there wasn't anything because otherwise the state would have used it in their case in chief if it did demonstrate a penetration or proof of a penetration. But it just whether it shows or doesn't show doesn't mean I don't have the opportunity to present it and or cross-examine on it.
Well, the question is prejudice, isn't it? I mean,
correct.
It was withheld. I guess that's conceded. I don't know. But so how would it have helped you, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think it goes to the issue of that if there isn't physical evidence of the penetration, that's one of the arguments to support the theory. There also could have been other things the child said. And those things would be potentially impeaching, or if there was another suggestion of what had happened. I don't know, and that's a rather frustrating position to be in because I simply don't know what that evidence is. It has never been presented to me.
Could you request the state to turn it over after you discovered that it exists?
Well, it was post-sentencing,
okay.
And I don't believe I specifically then asked the state's attorney to provide it at that point. There was a discovery order that specifically asked for disclosure of all of those records.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Cirska, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. On January 29, 2012, 7-year-old KJ revealed to her mother the defendant had been touching her sexually and making her watch pornography since she was 6 years old. Shortly thereafter, KJ was brought into a child advocacy center in Rapid City for a forensic interview. In that interview, KJ explained instances where a defendant had sexually assaulted her. Defendant made her watch pornography and masturbated in front of her. Defendant showed her pictures of his penis and pictures of defendant and KJ's mother engaging in sexual intercourse. Defendant showed KJ his penis and had her touch it in an up and down masturbating motion and also attempted to force her mouth on his penis. Defendant touched KJ's vagina and, in her words, touched under her dress, kinda digged in there, and kinda got my bone. On a picture of a girl, KJ pointed to a vagina when showing where a defendant had touched her. When asked KJ if defendant's finger did anything with that line, KJ replied, usually he went in it. Because defendant is deaf, Schultz texted defendant to come for an interview. Schultz texted defendant because that is defendant's preferred way of communication. Defendant arrived to the interview voluntarily and on his own. Schultz called dispatch to request an interpreter at the interview. Ms. Peterson interpreted the interview. Peterson and defendant had a long-standing working relationship of over 3 years. During that interview, defendant admitted to penetrating KJ's vagina. He explained that she pulled down her underwear and he rubbed her G-spot with his fingers to show her how to masturbate. Defendant also admitted to KJ touching his penis. Defendant was convicted by jury trial of first-degree rape, sexual contact with a child under the age of 13, and aggravated incest. The first issue is whether the trial court properly denied defendant's motion to suppress his statements to Investigator Schultz. The state submits that the trial court properly denied this motion because defendant's interview was non-custodial and defendant's statements were voluntary. When determining whether the defendant's statements were When determining whether defendant was in custody, there's a two-part test. What were the circumstances surrounding the interview, and would a reasonable person have felt he was at liberty to terminate the interrogation and leave? The trial court found the following factors determined that the circumstances surrounding the interview indicated defendant was not in custody. He voluntarily came to the public safety building after reading his text. He chose to speak to the investigator. He was not restrained. And Peterson and defendant's three-year working relationship, defendant never indicated that he did not understand her. When Schultz provided the non-custodial statement to defendant, he provided a written statement and also had Peterson sign it using sign language to defendant. It read, he was not under arrest, he was not being detained, he didn't have to talk if he didn't want to, and if he didn't want to talk, he could leave. The door was shut for privacy reasons, but unlocked, and Schultz was not arresting defendant that day. Thus, defendant agreed to talk. The trial court properly determined that the circumstances surrounding the interview was custodial. Now, the trial court held the following factors indicated a reasonable person would have felt he had the liberty to terminate the interrogation and leave. Defendant never expressed he didn't understand during the interview. The interview was cordial. There was a free-flowing communication. Schultz was not abusive, overly coercive, or overly aggressive. The trial court properly held under the objective totality of the circumstances, defendant was not in custody. Now, in regards to whether defendant's statements were voluntary, the trial court held they were voluntary because defendant had a high school education. He also went to Wyoming Tech School for 3 years. He was deemed to have average intelligence, average reading skill, the capability to understand and read the rights. In fact, he texts to communicate with the hearing world. He has the capability to read. And additionally, defendant's expert witness, Dr. Manlove, opined that he had the capability to read and understand his rights. Additionally, defendant is familiar with the criminal justice system. He has 3 DUIs and was arrested twice for domestic violence. Defendant voluntarily and willingly participated in the interview. Defendant demonstrated capacity to resist pressure by initially denying any sexual activity for 1 hour. Investigator Schultz did not deceive defendant in any way. Defendant's will was not overborne. And because Peterson and defendant worked together for 3 years, they worked in employment, counseling, and courtroom settings. Peterson knew defendant's conversational preferences. They were familiar with each other. Thus, under the totality of the circumstances, defendant's statements were voluntary, and the motion to suppress was properly denied. The next issue is...
How do you deal, though, with the expert that looked at the video and said that it's highly unlikely that a deaf person would have left under those circumstances, and that because of some errors in the communication that he didn't really understand his rights or his choices?
Well, Your Honor, she did say that, but also in her report, Witter-Merrithew also said that statement could have been understood several different ways. The investigator replied to the question asked. Additionally, the investigator said that that defendant responded appropriately to the questions asked by Schultz, thus showing that the lines of communication were going appropriately. The next issue is whether defendant is entitled to a new trial based on the state's alleged failure to disclose evidence. After KJ's forensic interview, KJ was examined by a physician. There's no determination of physical evidence of the abuse that happened about a year and a half before the physical examination. The penetration was in summer of 2010, and the physical examination was February 2012. Defendant argues that the state's failure to disclose the medical examination conducted on KJ is exculpatory evidence of prejudice defendant. In order to determine whether Brady violation has occurred, The court determines whether the evidence has been suppressed by the state either willfully or inadvertently, whether the evidence at issue is favorable to the accused because it's exculpatory or because it's impeaching, and whether prejudice has ensued. It appears from the record that the defendant did not receive a copy of Cage's medical examination and claimed to have only learned of the existence when he saw an invoice at sentencing. However, defendant was clearly aware of the existence of the report and its findings. Defendant got the report's findings to come in through Schultz's cross-examination and had him testify of the lack of evidence. And defendant stated and relied on the lack of physical evidence in the opening statement. Defendant got the information out.
Help me with that now again. You're saying that Schultz testified that there was a physical exam and the physical exam showed nothing?
Schultz testified that there was no physical evidence of sexual abuse.
But did he disclose the physical exam that was done on the child?
No, Your Honor. Just that there was no physical evidence.
Okay. Thank you.
In addition, to clarify, in the opening statement, the defense counsel stated there's no physical evidence of sexual abuse.
But this issue never came before the court, did it? The court never had a chance to rule on whether there was a Brady violation or not here?
No, Your Honor.
Would this be appropriate to remand to the court to determine, to look at the report and then determine whether there was prejudice?
I'm not sure if this is properly before the court. I did not brief on this issue. If you prefer, I could support you with a supplemental brief on this issue. However, the state argues that because it's not exculpatory nor impeaching, defendant was not prejudiced.
How do we know that, though? Nobody's seen the report but the state. How do we know what's in there and whether it's exculpatory or impeaching or not?
Well, it's not exculpatory because the defense counsel argued that there was a lack of physical evidence, and additionally...
Well, if the report showed no evidence, isn't that exculpatory then?
No, Your Honor, because the state doesn't need to prove any physical evidence when a sexual abuse happened. Additionally, it happened a year and a half before the physical examination. Thus...
Well, isn't that going to the weight of it, not to... the existence of whether or not it's exculpatory?
No, Your Honor. I believe that it's not exculpatory because in light of the testimony of Schultz saying that there is no physical evidence, the fact that the state doesn't need to prove any detection of sexual abuse in a medical examination, and in light of defendant's own admission and KJ's corroborating statements that he penetrated her. It's not exculpatory. Thus, defendant has not been prejudiced. No Brady violation has occurred, so it should not be reversible error.
The report is not in the record then, I take it?
No, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, the state asks to rely on briefs and affirm on all issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sirsko. And Ms. Fuller, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
If I may address some of the questions that the court raised, is it appropriate to remand based on the discovery violation? I would submit that is, yes, it would be appropriate to remand back to the circuit court for a determination, but I also believe this court has the jurisdiction to rule on its own under the statute that allows any remedy as the court feels just, and that's why I asked for a dismissal based on the discovery violation.
How can we know if it's prejudicial without looking at it? Without knowing what's in the report, how can we possibly make an appellate determination that it was prejudicial?
I think common sense tells you that it must have been exculpatory or else it would have been used in the case in chief. And so I think without the report, while I would like to have the report to be able to make the better argument, but it would have been used
if it was inculpatory, if it was pointing to penetration and consistent with the state's case. And so I think based on what's in front of you, we know it must be exculpatory and potentially prejudicial. Or and prejudicial, not potentially prejudicial. Okay. With regard to the question regarding whether it was, I think, exculpatory, or I think the question was, doesn't that go to the weight of the evidence? And absolutely, the results or anything that's contained in that physical examination does go to the weight of the testimony. It goes to the credibility of the child if there's impeaching testimony within there or inconsistent statements. So it does go to the weight, which is why we're prejudiced, because it's the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we don't have everything that's exculpatory to be able to cross-examine the state's witnesses, Mr. Johnson is prejudiced. There was another question with regarding how we deal with the expert testimony of Anna Witter Merrithew and how she concluded that he didn't understand that he was free to leave because it was confusing. And I think they can't respond to that because it's undisputed that there were interpretation errors, that there was a misunderstanding and a misinterpretation. There's no evidence to suggest it wasn't, that he was clearly advised of his right to leave.
But at the end of the day, the circuit court did not buy your argument, ruled otherwise.
That's correct. And that's why we're here.
And so how did the circuit court err?
I believe Judge Kern erred by discounting Anna Witter Merrithew's testimony and relying heavily on Katie Peterson, the interpreter's self-serving statements that she made no errors, that this is how I talk, this is how I communicated with Mr. Johnson, and relied overly heavy on that. And I think she also heavily relied upon the written statement that I believe I included as an exhibit in the brief or in an appendix to the brief. And when you take this piece of paper by itself, it appears that, do you have questions? No. And I think the court relied on that without objectively looking at the tape to see that what he was actually answering no to is, do you understand?
Going back to your argument on the difference between ALS and English, you commented that taking his cell phone was very critical because that was his means of communication. But you can't communicate ALS through a cell phone, can you?
No, you communicate in text language.
And text language is essentially English, kind of.
U, in the letter U instead of Y-O-U, thanks, T-H-X.
But it's a lot closer to English than it is to ALS.
Correct, because ALS is a visual language. And that's correct. But that, and I believe the state even said that he texted to communicate with the hearing world by texting. That was his preferred mode. That was his only mode of really communicating. And yes, it's a form of English. I'm not saying he's not apprised of somewhat of English. I'm saying he's not fluent in English, and there's a breakdown of understanding. And when you read this statement, it's not really clear. And in English, to someone who it's their second language. English is his second language, in essence. And he's not as fluent in that language as he should be to truly understand his rights as they're written. I would like to talk about Dr. Pfeifferman and the.
No, that's not fair because it didn't get brought up.
Thank you.
She can't rebut it.
Understand.
You can rebut anything she said in the last 20 minutes.
Thank you. I think it's important to note that the state relies heavily upon the nature of the charge. And that's why it's so significant, is this nature of the charge. It's not a pretty thing that is alleged to have happened. And
it's one of the worst crimes that our society views. And so the focusing on the facts, we need to set those aside to a certain degree to object, because if Mr. Johnson doesn't have the rights that someone that may have committed a petty theft or maybe, you know, a grand theft, if just because the crime is bad doesn't mean we can't still look harshly and hold the state to its burden and hold law enforcement to its burden and follow the Constitution for him. Because if it doesn't apply to him, it doesn't apply to any of us. And that's what we're arguing, is that based on the communication that happened in that interrogation, he didn't understand his rights, that he was free to leave. Therefore, he wasn't free to leave. He was in custody. And then also talking about, I believe, the voluntariness of his statements. It all intertwines with that right to free to leave, the head nodding of the interpreter as she's signing, in essence affirming everything law enforcement saying, we know you did it. And she's nodding in agreements that we know you did it. And that creates a coercive environment. And while the state said that Investigator Schultz was not overly abusive or aggressive, that's correct. And I acknowledge that. But when you look at the case law, it's whether he was verbally dominant, aggressive, confrontational, accusatory, threatening, or used other techniques. He doesn't have to be all of the things. He just has to utilize some of these things to create a coercive environment where he was not free to leave. Unless you have other questions, I'll again rest on the remaining issues in my brief, as I should have recognized I needed to do.
That's just fine.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Court will be in recess for 10.